Good morning, everyone. We're going to go ahead and open up the Senate Committee on Judiciary. We have four bills today for public hearing and possible work session. And the first three, I believe, Representative Cameron, you're here to speak on all three of them. So all I'm going to go ahead and do is open up a public hearing on all three so we can get your testimony on House Bill 2489, House Bill 2490, and House Bill 2623A. Thank you.
Commissioner Carlson, come.
You bet.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thank you for allowing us to testify on all three of these at one time. The three bills that we're talking about today are three of a series of six bills that are alive and in the building today on reentry. For the record, Representative Kevin Cameron, House District 19, Salem, Almsville, Turner. Sorry, Mr. Chair. And I serve on the Governor's Reentry Council for the last year and a half, and as well have participated here with Marion County and Commissioner Carlson in their reentry task force that they've put together that has flowed from a group of citizens and public service individuals here in Marion County that have done other things such as the meth task force and achieved many successes. The three bills before you are pretty simple, straightforward bills. The first one, 2489, directs the Department of Corrections to work with the transportation and making sure IDs are issued to people when they come out of the institution. Obviously, success of people when they come out is important to us to prevent recidivism. One of the things they need is an identification to help go get a job, an apartment, and those types of things. The second bill before you today, 2490, requires the Department of Corrections to provide offenders with documentation of programs that they've completed, i.e. helping them have a resume when they come out of prison to show to a potential employer or someplace that they may be going into further training, having that information together and organized. And then the third bill, 2623, is a bill that would allow Department of Corrections to grant up to 60-day reductions in for certain individuals if they complete various training programs while they're in Department of Corrections. So those are the three bills, and I'll be happy to answer any questions, and Commissioner Carlson can fill you in on even more details.
All right, I'm asking Walt Bigelow to call on up since he's on all three bills too. Janet?
Well, thank you, Chair Kosofsky, members of the committee. Janet Carlson, Marion County Commissioner. Just to give you a little bit of background about how I got involved with these bills, back in the late 1990s, I was brought into a project on children of incarcerated parents, and as the consultant, and did a lot of research and helped put together a design for Marion County on how their community corrections might work better with families. What I learned was, and I have a background, actually have a doctorate in children and families policy, is that the way that you get to the children is you work with their parents. And the children are involved sometimes in an intergenerational cycle of crime, but the parents don't often have the support of the community in terms of getting involved with them. So it was kind of an interesting twist on some of the policy issues that I had worked on in the past. When I became a county commissioner in 2003, of course, community corrections is under statute under the responsibility of the county commissioners. And in Marion County, we have a co-governance model between the Marion County Sheriff that manages community corrections and the county commissioners who are responsible by statute to govern that area. We have a community corrections board that we restructured a couple years ago. Marion County is the fifth largest county in terms of population, but it's the second largest county in terms of the number of folks that we have coming back from prisons, long history of prisons in Marion County, and obviously kind of a pooling effect, as we call it, Marion County from that long history. We have roughly 4,400 people under supervision in Marion County currently, about 700 a year coming out of the institutions back into our communities. So it is an issue that's of great community concern to us locally. I created a group in 2005 called the Barrier Busters and convened a group of folks to try to look at different barriers around issues about this population. We got a federal grant, did a survey, actually did one in 2005 and one in 2007 of folks who were in the jail. We found out meth, of course, was a huge issue. 73%, I think, were meth users, and about the same amount, about 73-74%, were parents. In fact, roughly in the high 400s of parents had over 1,100 children amongst them, and then we got a lot of data about analyzing what that population needed. And those basic things, housing, employment, substance abuse treatment, if necessary, mental health treatment, if necessary, education, those were the main things that came out of the survey as being necessary for this group. So you have a copy of a brochure that we worked on, and the statistics are a couple of years old because we worked on this, I think, in 2006, 2007 maybe. But the problem is still the same, and the work that we're doing is still the same. How do we get folks who are coming out of prison and going back into the community, have paid their debt to society, how do we get them stabilized with housing and with a job? Now, in the past, we haven't had really good methods to figure out who's going to be successful and who isn't going to be successful. So when employers stepped up and took a risk, sometimes folks worked out and sometimes they didn't. With the introduction of evidence-based practices in the last few years, and we've been working really hard in Marion County to align our processes, to work with the Department of Corrections on curriculum, to work with them on the assessment tools that we use, to institute more cognitive training into the array of services that we offer. I learned a couple years ago, again, when I first started this, I tallied the figures, and we were spending about $1 million a year on substance abuse treatment for a relatively small number of offenders. And our success rate was probably a little bit less than 50%. So you figure all of those dollars going into treatment and not necessarily a good result coming out of that treatment. What we learned is that some folks are not ready to do the work that they need to do and to make that commitment in order to be successful with treatment. So the introduction of cognitive classes for those folks before they go into treatment so they're ready for treatment is something else that we're working on. So anyway, with the work group, we started taking a look at some of the policy changes that needed to happen. We did some research, pulled some papers off the internet, found out what other states were doing, and these three bills actually came from three states that had implemented this legislation. We worked with the Governor's Reentry Council. A number of us that were on the Barrier Busters also served on the one-stop group, on the Employment Committee, and on the Housing Committee. And Walt is actually a member of the Governor's Reentry Council, so he's going to speak to that a bit more. They were actually looking to Marion County to come up with legislative ideas for them, and so we brought these and actually took the bills, the concepts at the time they weren't drafted, to that group to have them review and comment on them. And so now we're here, and these three bills actually went before the House Judiciary Committee. I'm pleased to report they did pass there unanimously and passed the House floor, I believe 60-0. All three of them passed unanimously on the House floor. So we believe they're sound pieces of legislation, and we're pleased that you're having a hearing on them today, and we'd be happy to answer any questions.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good morning. My name is Walt Beglaw. I'm the Marion County District Attorney, and I have also been serving on the Governor's Reentry Steering Committee and learning more about corrections and what we can do for inmates reentering our communities. I am here to express my support for all three of these bills, 2489, 2490, and 2623A and Gross. Really, I think they, if you look at them closely, they provide the legs for fundamental supports for inmates transitioning back into our communities in a healthy way. And we really, with my service on the steering committee, I've learned that we need to do more to provide for success on the outside and really reduce that risk of them falling back into corrections or back into our community corrections where it's very expensive. So just my one-liners on each one of these. On 2489, I learned very quickly at the steering committee group that this really the identification is the golden ticket that we need to supply for our individuals reentering. On 2490, it's important that we're making sure each inmate is equipped with the essential credentials that they need as they get back into the community and that they earned while they were there. And then on 26-23, really we need to give credit where credit is due. And so I'm here to express my support for these bills.
All right, thank you. Questions? Thank you very much. I have another panel. Let's see, Ginger Martin. I'm going to ask you to come on up since you want to speak on all three. And then Kate Newhall, I'm going to have you come up. Before you come up, let me just ask, is there anyone else, Ginger, go ahead. Is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony on House Bills 2489 or 2490? All right. Kate, come on up. And Ginger, whenever you'd like to get started.
All right, thank you. Chair Brzezinski, members of the Senate Judiciary, I'm Ginger Martin, Assistant Director for the Department of Corrections, responsible for the Transitional Services Division. I wanted to provide an update to you on where we are in terms of the principles in each of these bills, just for your information. Senate Bill or House Bill 2489 is the one that requires the Department of Transportation and the Department of Corrections to work together to provide ID before people leave prison. This is a goal of the Department of Corrections and also the Reentry Council. We understand the importance of having proper state-issued identification when people leave prison. We have a small pilot program going now between the Department of Transportation and the Department of Corrections where a limited number of inmates are served at a local DMV office before regular hours. They are receiving their state-issued identification through that process. As I said, it's a fairly small pilot at this time, but we're both agencies are figuring out what needs to happen so that this process works smoothly. We need to make sure that the inmates who are applying for identification have the proper documents and also that we're able to process the fees that they need to pay. The pilot is expected to go for 6 months, so we'll be done in August, and at that time the two agencies will determine how to expand the program, but that is our eventual intention. House Bill 2490 is the bill that requires the department to provide documents at the time of release that verify inmates' work record, educational programs, and treatment programs. Again, this is a goal of the Department of Corrections and of the Reentry Council to provide verification of work skills when people leave prison. We currently provide verification of treatment programs, vocational programs, and when people complete an educational or GED program. We are in the process of working on how to verify not only work skills, but also work not only work history, but also work skills and work performance while people are in prison. The challenge that we have is during the time a person is in prison, they may have many jobs and many supervisors, and a potential employer isn't going to want to, you know, search through lots and lots of materials. So we have a work group currently meeting that includes our vocational programs, our Measure 17 work programs, and Oregon Correctional Industries to create a process where we can verify work history and performance and create a system-wide verification process. And we expect that that would be in place by September.
All right. Ginger, does that take care of 2490 on your testimony?
Yes, that was 2490.
Okay. So what I'm going to do is ask the panel if you have any questions for Ginger regarding the first two bills, 2489 and 2490. Not seeing any. I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearings on those two bills, 2490 and 2489. And we'll go ahead and continue our public hearing on 2623. Yeah. Thank you.
2623 is the bill that would allow an inmate to earn up to 60 days of a reduction in the terms of his or her incarceration when completing a high school credential or college degree in prison. When a judge allows it at the time of sentencing, currently inmates earn a sentence reduction of up to 20% if they behave appropriately while in prison and if they attend required programming. So people who are in education programs now are that helps them earn toward their 20% of eligible good time. The bill creates a new way to earn time credits, but it doesn't increase the total sentence reduction available. Currently, we have about 760 GEDs issued each year. When inmates enter prison needing a credential, about 46% of them actually do earn their high school credential while they're incarcerated. Of those, about 65% are eligible for earned time. So of that group, about 500 are eligible for earned time. A percentage of those are already earning the maximum 20%, so they wouldn't be impacted by this new way to earn. So we're thinking that this will impact in the neighborhood of 200 or perhaps a slightly less people per year who would be able to earn additional earned time off of their sentence by completing an educational program.
All right. Kate, why don't you go ahead and sign in and give us your testimony.
Kate Newhall with the Bureau of Labor and Industries. I'm here today to offer our testimony on House Bill 2623. The Bureau, and first let me apologize for the very rude and intrusive disruption of my cell phone. I sincerely apologize. I thought it was off. Bully is very supportive of House Bill 2623 and Representative Cameron's efforts to increase transitional resources available to inmates and create incentives for them to participate in educational programs. At the Bureau of Labor and Industries, we administer registered apprenticeship programs, and we actually have currently 39 inmates who have participated in registered apprenticeship programs in Oregon correctional institutions. Of those 39 apprentices, five so far have sat for their exams, and four sat last December. Of note is that during this exam period, one of the inmates actually scored the highest exam score out of everybody taking the electrical exam that quarter. I just thought that was a fun one to acknowledge. Toward this end, Bully is here today to also support House Bill 2623, but to propose a small amendment to add participation in registered apprenticeship programs as one of the educational programs that would qualify for the 60-day reduction in sentence. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions that the committee may have about registered apprenticeship programs or the inmates currently participating in correctional institutions.
All right, Council.
Members, you have the Dash 2 amendments proposed by Bowley in a hand-engrossed version. And Ms. Newhall, would you distribute those? Apparently we didn't get copies in our packets. The amendment would add the completion of apprenticeship program that also can be counted toward reducing the sentence.
So, Ginger, while we're getting this stuff passed out, reading through your testimony handout, at this point, the Department of Corrections is in favor of seeing the 60-day reduction being used to allow an inmate to obtain what is now, a maximum of 20% sentencing reduction, but it would not be in addition to the 20% that could be currently claimed through that process.
Chair Przanski, I do think that this gives a second type of incentive for people who are participating in education programs. The law itself is not expanding the 20%.
Right.
So it'll provide an incentive.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Romici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Kate, have you discussed your amendment with the sponsors of the bill, and do you know if they support it? I should have asked them when they were up here.
Well,
I see nodding heads.
Okay. We did.
Yeah, I was going to ask that once everyone got home with it. So at this point, my understanding is that even though we may want to move this particular bill, because of the amendment, we need to get fiscals on it. So what we'll do is we'll bring this one back, and the other two... Well, let me ask this before we go get into work session type of work. Is there anyone else here that wanted to give testimony on House Bill 2623? Not seeing, I'm going to go ahead and close the work set or the public hearing on 2623. And colleagues, at this point, it looks like we could go ahead and start working our House bills. I spoke with staff this morning, and the paper flow is obviously manageable. We have these three bills that are kind of running together. We are going to need to hold over 2623 until we get the paperwork. Does the committee want to go ahead and start processing these? All right.
So,
yeah, we'll do that. All right, so I'm going to go ahead and first open up our first work session on House Bill 2489.
Chair, I move 2489 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
All right, Senator Boquist moves Senate House Bill 2489 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Happy to carry it, Mr. Mayor.
And Senator Boquist, you'll be our first carrier on this set of bills.
I think I should volunteer for the next one.
All right, so we're going to close the work session on 2489, open the work session on House Bill 2490.
Mr. Chair, move 2490 to the floor with a due pass.
Senator Boquist moves House Bill 2490 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And Senator Dingfelder will be our carrier on 2490. And I'll close the work session on House Bill 2490. And I'll open up a work session on House Bill 2623A. And for the purpose of adopting the A2 amendment.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Senator Boquist moves that we adopt the A2 amendment to House Bill 2623. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And at this point, we'll have to wait for fiscals to come back on that, but we'll get that one scheduled for a work session as soon as it gets the paperwork catches up with it. With that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 2623. And thank everyone who came forward today. And now we're going to move into our last bill that we've scheduled for public hearing and possible work session, House Bill 2498. And Council, why don't you give us an overview?
Yes, House Bill 2498 is sponsored by the Port of Portland. It does two different things. The first is to create the crime of endangering an aircraft in the second degree. That involves carrying firearms in restricted areas of airports. The second part is that it expands the port's policing authority to all the property owned by the port and not just the area around the airport. The port has submitted the -2 amendments you have to change the word dangerous to deadly. That was their original intent. There was a drafting error, but this parallels federal law, and so that's the purpose of changing the language with the -2 amendments.
All right, thank you. So I'm looking to see who we have here. We have four individuals, one that may not be speaking to us, but is going to join us at the podium. So why don't we bring up another chair? It looks like Annette Price, Chief Bill Zaklan, and then also Officer Michael Esther, and K-9 Linda. I guess she doesn't need a chair. Okay. All right, thank you.
Facing the wrong way, though.
That's right. I love it. I love it.
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Annette Price, the State Affairs Manager for the Port of Portland, and today I'm here to introduce our Chief of Police, Chief Phil Klon. Phil will go through the bill and discuss the amendment and answer any questions you may have. Chief?
Thank you, Annette. Good morning. I'm Phil Klon, Chief of Police with the Port of Portland Police Department. I'll try not to get upstaged by Linda.
It will never happen.
Tough one. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thank you for your time this morning. We speak to you this morning on an issue that I consider to be a public safety and port security bill. House Bill 2498 includes three changes to ORS. Revised language in ORS 778.260 to better reflect the needs of the port in protecting its facilities and operations. The inclusion of the port police in the definitions of police officer and enforcement officer in the part of the ORS that is the Oregon Vehicle Code. And finally, amended language to ORS 164.885, endangering aircraft. This creates a misdemeanor charge for possession of a firearm or deadly weapon in the restricted areas of a commercial service airport. House Bill for your consideration. We're proposing changing the word dangerous that occurs on page 1, lines 19 and 21. In both instances, changing that word to deadly. This is after consultation with the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office and a recommendation that the term deadly weapon as defined in ORS is the appropriate term for this section to align us with those federal regulations. A little bit about the Port Police Department. We have 53 sworn officers. We attend the Police Academy. We are state-certified officers with the same authority as other officers in the state of Oregon. We're responsible for providing the police services to the Portland International Airport. To include non-emergency and emergency calls for service, we investigate crimes, do preventative patrol, and we enforce traffic laws on the surrounding roadways. Port police officers also, in addition to their traditional law enforcement duties, have to respond to airport security matters. We ensure that the airport is in compliance with the Transportation Security Administration aviation security directives and requirements. Airport law enforcement is basically local state-certified officers who work at an airport who not only apply state and criminal laws but also provide for the requirement of law enforcement officers under Title 48 CFR 1542, which is a federal regulation for airport security. And under that regulation, the airport operator in Portland International Airport, that would be the Port of Portland, they have to provide law enforcement personnel in sufficient numbers to support the security program at the airport. In addition, that also requires those law enforcement officers to have authority to arrest for the criminal laws of the state, have appropriate uniform and badge, firearms training, and some other training as well. At an airport, the federal criminal code does have crimes for major crimes such as air piracy, terrorism, and violent crimes, and we would work with our federal partner, the FBI, on those specific things. There are a host of federal civil regulations that also apply and specific to the possession of firearms and other weapons in restricted areas of an airport. There are civil aviation penalties that can be applied after the fact by our partners at TSA. However, the Port Police officers who respond to those incidents need to have state and or local laws that enable us to take immediate action. And in our research, we found that most states, including California and Washington, have enacted airport-specific laws that enable airport law enforcement to take enforcement action immediately as aligned with those federal civil aviation regulations. The terrorist attacks of September 11th obviously changed the security environment at airports. It also has had an effect on the Marine side as well. The Marine security ports that the Port of Portland operates, they have their own set of federal regulations. They are regulated by the U.S. Coast Guard. They have their own facility security program, which complies with federal regulations. Internally, the Port of Portland has realigned its security organization to encompass all departments under security, part of Bill Wyatt's One Port concept. So public safety includes police, fire, aviation security, marine security, emergency communications, and emergency management. While our primary mission for Port of Portland Police is the protection of the airport, in the last 4 or 5 years, we've supported the Marine side through special operations, through some investigations assistance. I'm actually going to let Officer Mike Esther talk a little bit about his involvement on the Marine side. So we have been a presence on the Marine terminals in support of the Port of Portland goals of security. We're not alone in our efforts. We rely very much on our mutual aid partners. We have good working relationships with the Portland Police Bureau and Multnomah County and other local and federal agencies. And as part of our testimony, you have letters from Multnomah County Sheriff Bob Skipper, the Multnomah County DA Michael Schrunk. You should have, we're hoping that you'll soon have a letter in hand from the Portland Police Chief, Rosie Sizer, and also one from the Oregon Association of Chiefs of Police, their Executive Director, Kevin Campbell. All those folks have provided letters of support in support of 2498. So quickly to run through some of the specifics of the language of the bill. House Bill 2498 amends the airport's references in 77.78.260 to include all port properties. This aligns legislative language with the overall mission of the Port of Portland, and it positions the Port of Portland to move quickly to address changes in security requirements for any and all of its operations, including the marine security site. 2498 also clarifies language in 778.260 by eliminating the language at airports owned, operated, maintained, or controlled by the port, which reflects the port police have the same authority as other police officers in the state of Oregon. And as I've mentioned, there's a couple of minor language changes in the Oregon Vehicle Code, including port police in the definitions of police officer and enforcement officer. Finally, the amended language to the endangering aircraft section, specific to the possession of a firearm or deadly weapon in the restriction areas of a commercial service airport linked to the Federal Civil Aviation Code. This is in support of the Port of Portland police officers in their role as first responders and the primary peacekeepers at PDX. This language enables those officers to arrest, detain, and criminally charge individuals who are unlawfully armed in areas that are basically in direct access to airplanes, the restricted area of the airports, and the sterile area, the non-public areas of a commercial airport. These incidents, although they don't happen very frequently, are often of national significance, and while they may lead eventually to federal criminal charges, generally that's only after local law enforcement has taken initial action. The mission of the Port of Portland is to provide competitive cargo and passenger access to regional, national, and international markets while enhancing the region's quality of life. In pursuit of this mission, the Port of Portland has many facilities and operations that must be safeguarded to ensure a vibrant economy for Oregon. House Bill 2498 preserves the Port's rights to use all of its resources to accomplish its mission and to protect all of its assets. Thank you, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
All right. Why don't we have Officer Esther give his testimony, and then we'll open up for questions. Thank you.
Good morning.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Chief Pond took a lot of my thunder. But I do have a few comments I'd like to make.
I need you to first put your name on the record.
Please. I will. My name is Mike Esther. I'm a police officer, canine handler, as you can see, with the Port of Portland. And this is my canine partner, Linda. We are here in support of House Bill 2498.
She's ready to work.
She is.
What's her name?
Linda is a explosive detection dog, and we're both graduates from the National Explosive Detection K-19 program down at Lackland Air Force Base in San Antonio. I had to move there for 3 months to train down there before bringing Linda back home.
What time of year were you in San Antonio?
June, July, and August.
I was raised there for 18 plus years.
I feel
your pain.
And sunburn.
Great people, nice barbecue. The weather was awful. Very hot and humid. Besides being a canine handler for the port, I'm also the president of the Port of Portland Police Association, ASME Local 1847, and I'm a member of the ASME's International Law Enforcement Advisory Committee back in Washington, D.C. I've been a police officer for almost 29 years, and I've been with the port for 24 years this month. Emily Stevenson once said that change is inevitable, and change for the better is a full-time job. House Bill 2498 is a change for the better for our department, for the Port of Portland, and for the state of Oregon. Over the years, much like the Port of Portland, the police department's duties and responsibilities have expanded in a manner consistent with the changing times of our state and nation, as Chief Kwan has mentioned. For example, concerning the canine unit, we have four teams at the Portland Airport. We are now an active member of the Portland Metropolitan Explosive Disposal Unit, or MEDU, which is comprised of bomb techs and from both city, county, and federal agencies. we provide assistance to, and we occasionally work in partnership with other bomb tech groups, such as the Oregon State Police and Salem Police bomb techs, if we were called upon. For example, the MEDU, we were called into service to come down to Woodburn last December for the bank bombing down there. Our teams working with the MEDU and the Secret Service are also used in providing dignitary protection for political leaders when the President of the United States comes into town, visiting foreign dignitaries or other VIPs. We are pressed into service, and we provide our canines for that service. What has changed recently is the canine teams are now tasked with performing sweeps of both domestic and international cargo at the Portland Airport, per the TSA requirements, for what Chief Klon has mentioned. We are now are searching these cargo placements on these aircraft. We also perform random sweeps of carry-on luggage at checkpoints. I don't know, you'll see us there every now and then. Teams, along with the help and support of the Ports and Marine Security Division, the TSA, ICE, Immigration Customs Enforcement, and the U.S. Coast Guard have over the last, I think we started doing it last year, have been conducting random sweeps at the Terminal 6 facility of the cargo ship containers. We go down there, all of our dogs will go down there, and randomly begin searching, kind of, keeping people off guard type thing. Needless to say, the canine unit, at least, for the port, has been very busy in providing public service to our community and to the traveling public at PDX in particular. I'm the resident historian of the department, as you can imagine, being there for 24 years, and I've seen many changes at PDX and within the Port of Portland over the last 24 years, in both the physical development and expansion of the airport and the marine facilities. The increased traveler and cargo loads that have come through, the required changes and adjustments needed to protect the public and secure property in a post-9/11 world. They reflect not only on the changing and expanding role of the Port of Portland, these changes also reflect the ever-growing duty and responsibility of the port that the port has to the people and to the state. Our attempt to secure House Bill 2498, the process we've taken to get to this point today, is indicative of one primary objective: the port's commitment towards protecting their employees, their customers, and to the public. In this process, which has led to this moment, as the Chief has mentioned, the Port has taken steps to change for the better. The Port, or more specifically Chief Klon, has been the point over the last several years to change these statutes as outlined in House Bill 2498, and he has the full support of my members in this effort. In today's world, the port must have the authority to protect its own interests and properties. Our interests are your interests. Our interests are the state's interests. Port of Portland properties have a direct impact on what enters and exits the state, whether it's by boat, aircraft, or rail. The law needs to be amended so that as to allow the port to utilize its police officers in the same consistent manner enjoyed by every other police agency in this state. Agencies that are equally responsible by law to protect the interests and properties of their respective city, county, and state agencies, or governments as well. Imagine what our lives would be like today if we were still living under laws written 50 years ago. Likewise, 50 years ago, no one could have envisioned what the port would be faced with today, with today's world looks like. Change. Time has changed. Times have changed, excuse me. The port's responsibilities to the state have not only changed for the better, but have grown. I respectfully ask this committee to be a force of change, to be a force of change for the better, and adopt House Bill 2498, which we have before you today. In closing, Linda and I wish to thank the committee for your time and consideration. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
All right. Thank you very much. Questions for panel? Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, I don't have any In fact, I think sections two onward is great. I have no problem with them, and I frankly don't have any problem with section one as explained by the chief. However, as written, it says something quite different, and it may have some serious unintended consequences. So I guess I'll start with a few questions, Mr. Chair, and see if the chief can respond or at least get back with us that. In section one, I mean, the intent, of course, is to, in the passenger terminals and in the cargo terminals that are controlled for commercial cargo transport and passenger transport, is to provide a penalty for carrying, for an individual carrying a weapon, so on and so forth like that. But as you read this, several things jump out. Control of firearm is also the same terminology used in our federal, and I guess for the record, Mr. Chair, I own an aviation company. I've been involved in the transit FBO, and I've been involved in seizing aircraft back, so I'm really familiar with the problems they face. But control of firearm is also the same terminology utilized by commercial airlines when they take possession of the firearm in a lockbox. It goes through TSA and comes through, so that's a concern I have. Another concern I have in how the language, not the intent, the language is written is commercial service airport. Both TSA and FAA have swept back and forth in that terminology as saying FBOs who provide charter aircraft fall under that category, such as Hillsborough, Troutville, and Molino, along with virtually every other FBO in the state of Oregon. So I have concerns about how that terminology is written and the sweepingness of what we're attempting to do here versus in the language versus your intent. Because if you go to some of the FBOs, you see restricted signs that are, FAA and TSA has told them to put up in FBOs. I mean, a good example might be Independence Airport, which has them right on the sign, and it has a fence about 3 foot tall, and it's about as secure as keeping water buffaloes out. But that fits the same category right here. And so the unintended consequences. So if you can maybe control firearm, how you're going to deal with commercial airlines, and then address the FBO issue and how we might fix that.
So why don't we put on the record FBO?
Thank you.
Fixed-based operator. That's a commercial transport aircraft company that flies private aircraft on charter, or maybe a smaller service. And it also may be a regional service operating. I don't think Hillsborough has them anymore. But no, Hillsborough has FBOs, but I don't know if they have a small commercial operation out of there. But small airports like yours, they wouldn't be like Eugene or Medford or Pendleton, who actually fall under commercial passenger service. But this is a broad sweeping term here. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Chair and Senator Boquist, there are two terms in the section four of, well, in the subsection 4 of section 1, which defines what a restricted access area is. And the meaning by that is a commercial service airport, but underneath that it talks about that it's designated as restricted. In other words, it's an area that's restricted under an airport security program that's approved by the federal TSA. And now, my understanding, and we can certainly take that question back, but my understanding is, for the most part, general aviation airports, we'll take, for example, at PDX, we have commercial service airlines, but we also have flight craft, which has a mixed use, which is considered a general aviation area. That area of flight craft is there are not regulations that apply to the ramp area of flight craft. You can, if you are legally in possession of a firearm or a weapon in the public, you can walk onto the ramp, the general aviation ramp. When the federal regulations come into play, is there are certain airplanes that you're required to screen to a certain level by TSA. For example, if you are operating a large charter jet, there are some regulations in play that require you to screen passengers before they get on the airplane. Those regulations don't really have to do with the area as much as boarding an airplane. In terms of, if I understand you correctly, you make a differentiation between a commercial service airport and a commercial service airline,
commercial passenger service, which is the federal term.
Okay, commercial passenger service. I think that's something we'll need to take back and get some clarification on.
I'll follow up, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Hey, could you go back up and address the, and I appreciate your answer, but those of us that are in the aviation business get the TSA and FAA draft rules constantly, and so they're always targeting FBOs to change FBOs across the nation to fall under these exact rules.
Right.
But controls of firearm, I mean, the wordage there, why you pick that, and I'm assuming obviously there's an exemption for Delta and Northwest and United who, as I said, take control of those firearms at the counter and then put them through TSA.
And Senator Boqvist, in that paragraph, subsection 2B, it says it does not apply to a person authorized under federal law or an airport security program to possess or control a firearm or deadly weapon as amended in a restricted area access. And we believe that would cover the airlines under 1544 and their operations.
Last follow-up, Mr. I would like to follow up at a later point on these other issues.
Yeah. I think the chair's desire at this point is to have you work with the proponents to maybe work with LC to capture the language that we need to make certain that we've got everything in place and we don't have any unintended consequences. The other part, I'm just going to put this on the record because I see above that 2 sub B and 2 sub A is also the term controls a firearm. And so I'm not sure if that makes any difference in interplay between the two subchapters under 2. But so I think that's probably what we should do. The one thing I do want to do is to say, take any other questions we've got, Senator Wissett, and then we'll move into a work session to adopt the amendment, and then we'll move from there.
Thank you, Chair Przanski. I apologize for being late. I was in another meeting, but had two concerns with this bill, and one of them I think is in the dash, one of the amendments in changing dangerous weapon to deadly weapon, and the other is, can you explain your training procedures for the Port of Portland police officer, peace officers?
I'm going to ask them to do that with you offline because we've already gone through all that. That's within the testimony that the chief has given us.
That's very good. Thank you.
Okay.
I'll read it.
And they'll be glad to follow up with you if any other questions. He has he handed out a two-page testimony. Two and a half, actually.
Mr. Chair, Linda would be happy to give you the remedial training.
Any other questions, comments? All right. Thank you all very much. And let me see if there's anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on House Bill 2498. Not seeing anyone. I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing. And I'm thinking of doing a work session to take in the dash twos, but if we're going to have some other amendments, instead of putting them in and confusing LC, I think what we're going to do is we're going to hold off on the dash twos. And have Senator Boqvist work with the proponents, and then we'll decide on what any other changes need to be made, and we can incorporate the change in the dash twos into whatever the other amendment is. If there's not a need to have any other additional amendments, then we'll just adopt the dash twos.
Makes sense.
All right. Any other comments on this one? And everyone will work with Lisa as our committee counsel on this one. All right. So I'm going to go ahead and close the, I'm not going to do anything else on that. I already closed the House Bill 2498 public hearing. Is there anything else that we need to cover today? All right. With that, we're going to go ahead and conclude for today. Tomorrow is Wednesday, and we're scheduled to be here at 8:30. With that, the Senate Committee on Judiciary is adjourned.